The Serbian Solution, Chapter 1. 1957, United Kingdom. The journey had been long. Three times Uncle Cyril was forced to pull the car over to the side of the road. Lisbeth's mother helped her out of the car and watched her as Lisbeth stood in the shadow of the big gray car, heaving and retching and generally hating the whole experience. Someone suggested she should sit on a piece of newspaper. It was supposed to stop motion sickness. Someone else suggested ice cream. It was cold, and it paralyzed the stomach. Her mother said, "No, she'll be all right. It was only another 10 miles. Lisbeth leaned against an old stone milepost, and with a damp hand, she traced the lettering on the granite block. She read the words aloud, proud of herself. Dragon's Green, X. May, 1991, United States. Lisbeth Price sat up suddenly in the hospital bed. The room was dimly lit by the light from the corridor and the digital readout on the IV pump at her bedside. Sitting up had been a bad idea. Everything hurt. She concentrated on localizing the pain. Her arms and legs were okay. Her head didn't hurt. All the pain was at the site of the incision in her abdomen. The dream was still vivid. The bright blue of the English summer sky, the leafy canopy over her head, her mother in a blue flowered dress. Lisbeth could smell the engine fumes from the old gray car and the acrid cigarette smoke drifting up from the two men who had been sitting in the front seat. It was, she decided, all those hours in the smoke-filled car that had made her nauseous. Or maybe not. Maybe it was the anesthetic. Someone had given her an anesthetic. The two things seemed to blend together. The nausea from the hours in the car and the nausea from the anesthetic. Whatever it was worth all of it to have that sudden, clear vision of the milestone. Dragon's Green, X. She turned uncomfortably. The incision was only hours old, and located the light switch. When the nightlight came on beside her bed, her roommate shifted in protest behind the curtain with a token groan of resentment and then lapsed into silence. Lisbeth gritted her teeth, ignored the pain of her incision, and opened the top drawer of the bedside table. She located her purse and dragged it across the bed and onto her lap. She kept her mind focused on the image of the milestone, seeing every detail of the ancient carving. What drug had she been given this time? What new formulation of chemicals had finally succeeded in unlocking her memory? How amazing that the memory was still there, still accessible after 34 years, the vivid memory of her 4-year-old self standing by that faraway roadside. Whatever the drug was, it was a potent one. Lisbeth's strength was fading fast, and she wanted to lie back down in the pristine hospital bed and sleep. At last, she located her address book. Every 5 or 6 years, she would buy herself a new address book and mentally and physically toss away the names of the many people who no longer counted in her life. Ex-girlfriends, ex-business partners, an ex-husband, acquaintances on both sides of the Atlantic. But she always transferred one number, filed under S, for Stefan. Last time, she had even checked the international code and updated it. Thank heaven, she thought. She was in no condition to be wandering off to find a phone directory and discover the correct code for calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to Swansea in Great Britain. But by the time she had dialed the international code and her own phone credit card number, her mind was fogging over again, and the dream was returning. The faraway ringing of the phone blended into the sounds of an English summer's day. She could smell the dank, fertile undergrowth and her own childish vomit. Flies buzzed around her head. No, not flies, the rhythmic, high-pitched pulsing of a British telephone. She dragged her mind back into the present and concentrated on a woman's voice announcing a phone number. Lisbeth recalled that the British answered their phones by announcing their phone numbers and then waiting. She'd done the same thing herself before she left home and become an American. On the other end of the line, the British woman announced the phone number for a second time. What the hell time of day was it in Europe anyway? Lisbeth had no idea. She didn't even know what time of day it was in Pittsburgh. It had been sunset when she had drifted off into the heavily drugged sleep. It was fully dark now, and the hospital was quiet. Sometime between midnight and dawn. Daytime in Europe. Could I speak to Stefan, please?
Stefan who?
The voice was an irritating one. Young and high-pitched and superior.
I'm sorry, Lisbeth stammered. I don't remember his last name, but I've had his number for years.
She knew she was slurring her words, and to make matters worse, she was sliding helplessly down into her pillows, losing her grasp on the phone receiver. She probably sounded drunk, she thought. She was sure that that woman at the other end of the line could not possibly be impressed by Lisbeth's manner, but a national habit of politeness could not be easily shaken.
I'm sorry, madam. Perhaps if you could describe the gentleman?
Oh, yes. Lisbeth struggled to sit upright.
Well, he'd be elderly now,
I suppose. I haven't seen him since 1978.
1978?
The polite voice had a Welsh accent and belonged to a girl, Lisbeth decided, rather than a woman. No doubt about it.
It's really important, Lisbeth pleaded. I'm calling from the States, from America.
Oh, the voice was impressed.
Do you know a Stefan? Lisbeth asked. He gave me this number years ago, and it's really important. Who am I talking to, by the way?
The voice refused to answer that particular question, but she did say,
You might mean Stefan Bubani. He's not living in Swansea anymore.
But could you reach him? Lisbeth asked. The phone was slipping from her grasp again, and reality was sliding away. A canopy of trees was forming over her head, shutting out the light. It was very irritating, she thought. Leafy, English trees intruding into the hospital room like this.
I could give him a message, I suppose, the Welsh girl said. Do you want him to ring you?
Yes, yes, Lisbeth said. He should... She hesitated. He should ring me, she said eventually, uncomfortable now in her use of English phrases.
Tell him to call Lisbeth Price, will you please?
Thank you very much. Lisbeth stretched out her arm to replace the receiver and then realized the thin, faraway voice was still speaking. How strange, she thought. The British were not usually so chatty on the phone. She put the receiver to her ear.
Hello? Hello? Said the polite voice. Are you still there? Mrs. Price, Mrs. Price.
Yes. The Welsh girl was humoring her now, Lisbeth thought, speaking loudly and distinctly for the benefit of this strange American drunk.
Does he know your number, Mrs. Price?
What? Said Elizabeth.
Oh, no, you're right, of course. He doesn't know my number.
She hesitated. I don't know my number. Just a minute.
Perhaps if you were to ring back later, the voice suggested, when you're feeling better.
No, said Elizabeth. He should be told now. I should talk to him right away. While I still remember.
But perhaps in the morning you might,
Lisbeth recognized the polite hint. No doubt the distant girl was thinking that in the morning Lisbeth might be able to recall her phone number.
I'm trying to find it, Lisbeth said.
She felt defeated. The phone on the nightstand was cloaked in darkness. If there was a number written on it, it was doomed to remain a mystery. Movement was so painful, so incredibly painful, and there was something tied to her arm, something which impeded her movements. She stared at the thin plastic tubing, tracing its path upward to the stand beside the bed and the plastic bag of fluid.
IV, she said to herself. Come on, get a grip. I'm sorry, she said into the phone. I can't give you the number. I'm in a hospital, you see.
Oh, I'm sorry, said the distant Welsh voice, sounding not at all sympathetic.
Nothing serious,
Lisbeth reassured her, in response to a question which hadn't been asked.
But it's a little awkward at the moment. That's why I'm calling you, you see. The drugs they gave me helped me to remember.
Oh, yes.
It doesn't matter, Lisbeth said. Stefan will understand. Tell him that I'm in Northern General Hospital, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm sure he'll be able to find the number. Tell him I've remembered.
Remembered?
They've all been waiting, Elizabeth said. For years, all of them. They've been waiting for me to remember. But I never could. I was only 4 years old at the time.
Of course.
I'm not crazy, Lisbeth protested. You tell Stefan what I said, and he'll tell you that I'm not crazy. With everything that's happening now, everything that's going on over there, it could make all the difference. Tell him I remember where it was. Please.
Northern General Hospital?
Repeated the precise British voice with its sing-song Welsh lilt.
Pittsburgh, Lisbeth added.
And you're Lisbeth Price, and you've remembered, the voice confirmed.
Yes, said Lisbeth.
She let the receiver fall from her grasp and leaned back against the pillows. She closed her eyes. The trees closed in above her head.
X, her mother was saying, is a Roman numeral. Not that you have to worry about that, lovey. X means 10.
X means 10, Elizabeth Price said aloud in her hospital room.
Only 10 miles to go now, her mother said. Do you think you can get back into the car?
Elizabeth's childish self quailed at the very thought of re-entering the stuffy interior of the car, with its smell of gasoline and exhaust fumes, old leather and cigarette smoke. But she obediently grasped her mother's hand. One of the men held the door open for them.
She is all right now? He asked.
He had a deep, ugly voice and made the words sound harsh.
We can go a bit further, her mother said. She's a good girl. She always lets me know in time.
The driver turned in his seat, and Lisbeth saw a dark, heavy face with fierce eyebrows. A stubby little cigarette drooped from his thick lips.
You should not have brought her, he announced.
His accent was thick and ugly like the other man's, but Lisbeth was not surprised. She seemed to be accustomed to these accents.
He's her brother, said Lisbeth's mother, drawing Lisbeth closer to her blue-flowered bosom. The child should see him again. I think if you could put out your cigarette, she might feel better.
The driver tossed the cigarette into the ground at Lisbeth's feet. She watched its glow die as it settled into the damp grass. It had been raining. She remembered the rain. It had rained almost all the way. The sun had only just come out, just as they crossed the border. Lisbeth climbed out of her dream.
Border, she asked herself. What border?
She turned off the nightlight, pressed her hands to her bandaged abdomen, and fell into a fitful sleep. The dream continued.
Mummy,
Lisbeth muttered.
Mummy.
Overcome with a strong feeling that something terrible was about to intrude on her dream, she tried to wake herself up. Stop dreaming, she told herself. Stop dreaming, and you won't have to see it.
Mummy, she implored. Talk to me. Please, Mummy, wake up. Why won't anyone wake up?
She forced her eyes open and saw the shadowy hospital room. She was certain that she had escaped from a nightmare. If she had stayed asleep any longer, she would have seen something terrible. She soon realized what had woken her. A bright light was burning behind the curtain that separated her from her roommate, and the nurses were talking in loud, annoyed whispers.
Get back into bed, Mrs. Morrison.
Shadows moved behind the curtain, and Lisbeth could see the shadowy forms of Mrs. Morrison and the nurse who held her arms.
"We don't want you to get up now, dear. It's the middle of the night," said another tired but patient voice.
Mrs. Morrison's crackled and confused voice offered a protest, but she was overwhelmed by a command to "lie down, dear, and be a good girl," followed by an explanation from the other voice that Mrs. Morrison was in the hospital. And Mrs. Morrison had a broken hip, and Mrs. Morrison would have to stop trying to get out of bed. One of the nurses said loudly and clearly, "Oh, shit!" And the second nurse said with an edge of annoyance,
You have to tell us, dear, when you want to go to the bathroom. You can't keep doing this in the bed.
Lisbeth settled herself back against the pillows, confident that she wouldn't be drifting off to sleep in the next couple of minutes. The nurses moved back and forth behind the curtain, rustling sheets and ignoring Mrs. Morrison's complaints. The activity was interrupted by a masculine voice.
"Is all this noise really necessary?" it asked. "I have patients on this floor who need to sleep."
"Good evening, doctor. We didn't expect you here so late," said one voice.
"We're having a minor emergency," said the other.
"So I see," said the masculine voice.
"How's Miss Price? This is her room, isn't it?"
"She was sleeping the last time I checked," came the quiet reply.
"I doubt if she's sleeping now," the doctor retorted.
The curtain was twitched aside and a shadow loomed towards her.
"Miss Price?"
Lisbeth made out the face of the doctor she had seen in the emergency room several hours earlier.
"Doctor," she couldn't remember his name.
"Perenyi," he said.
"Alex Perenyi."
She nodded.
"How are you feeling?"
"I don't know," she replied.
"What did you do to me?"
He moved closer to the bed and she was able to make out his features. He was tall and slim, with straight dark hair and deep-set eyes. He appeared to be unshaven and somewhat rumpled, but as it was the middle of the night, she couldn't hold that against him.
"You don't remember?" he asked.
She shook her head.
"I removed your gallbladder and some infected intestine."
"Oh, yes, now I remember. It was all so sudden."
"You left it too long before you came into the emergency room," he said. "If you had come in sooner, we might have found an alternative treatment."
Lisbeth shrugged her shoulders.
"I was very busy," she said.
His attention had wandered. He checked the pump feeding her IV tube. He checked the bed controls and the TV remote. He seemed puzzled.
"What's the matter?" Lisbeth asked.
"I can hear a noise," the doctor said. "I shall have to turn on the light." He reached across her and turned on the bedside light. She could see him clearly. He looked tired, distracted, and distant. He made a noise which Lisbeth could only interpret as a snort of masculine disdain, and picked up the phone receiver, which had been buried in her bedclothes and was still emitting a dial tone.
"Was it really necessary to make a phone call?" he asked.
Lisbeth stared uncomprehendingly at the phone receiver. The doctor replaced the receiver and straightened her bedclothes.
Lisbeth continued to stare at the phone. Who had she been calling? She couldn't remember.
The doctor picked up her heavy purse and began to collect her various belongings, which were scattered across the bed. She tried to concentrate on the purse. What had she been doing? What was she looking for?
"I know women don't like men messing with their handbags," the doctor said. "But you can't leave this all over the bed. You have to get your rest."
He picked up her address book and dropped it into the purse.
"Wait," said Lisbeth.
She reached out her hand for the address book.
"Miss Price," said Dr. Perenyi.
"You really must rest. There's no business that you need to conduct at 4 in the morning.
4 o'clock, said Lisbeth.
Then she remembered.
"Oh, that's all right. I was calling Europe. I guess I didn't wake anyone up."
She laughed, remembered the puzzling but polite Welsh girl who had answered the phone.
"They must have thought I was drunk," she said.
Dr. Perenyi looked at her quizzically.
"I was trying to place your accent," he said. "Not quite American. I thought maybe Australian."
"Nothing so exotic," said Lisbeth. "I was brought up in Britain, but I've been in the States for a long time. I don't make an issue of my background. It gets in the way of business." The doctor nodded.
"Lisbeth Price," he said.
"I've seen your name on for sale signs all over the North Hills."
Lisbeth's response was automatic.
"$1 million club," she said.
"Are you thinking of selling or buying, doctor?"
Dr. Perenyi scowled. "You people never miss an opportunity, do you?" he said.
"Real estate's a tough business," Lisbeth countered.
Dr. Perenyi nodded without speaking and picked up her chart from the end of the bed.
"What are you giving me, doctor?" Lisbeth asked.
"Tolwyn," he said. It's a synthetic opiate.
It's amazing, said Lisbeth. I've been having such vivid dreams.
The doctor smiled, and Lisbeth found herself liking the younger, kinder man revealed by that sudden smile.
Don't get too used to it, he said. It's very addictive. We'll get you off it as soon as possible.
No hurry, Lisbeth thought, remembering the prize that she had finally gained. Dragon's Green, X.
Lie back, please, Miss Price. I want to check the incision.
Lisbeth lay back on the bed. The doctor hesitated, his hand on the sheet, and then called out,
Nurse?
A nurse came from behind the curtain. Lisbeth was relieved that it was the nurse who pulled back the sheet and lifted the hem of the hospital gown. She hadn't been embarrassed when Dr. Perrenia had examined her in the emergency room, but he hadn't looked so rumpled then, or so human, and she hadn't seen that engaging smile. He pressed lightly on her navel, and she gasped.
Sorry, he said.
He twitched the sheet back into position. You're doing fine.
Would you like a different pain medication if the dreams are troubling you?
Lisbeth thought about her last dream. She was with her mother in the back of that old gray car. The car was tilted at a strange angle, and her mother's weight was crushing her. She didn't like this memory. She didn't like the pain her child self was feeling, but it was important, and she had to see it through to the end. She shook her head.
I'm all right, she said.
The doctor reached over and turned out the light.
Good night, Miss Price, he said.
The nurse laid a soothing hand on Lisbeth's forehead.
Try to sleep, she said.
The touch blended into Elizabeth's returning dream.
Her mother's touch?
No, not her mother. Another hand. A man's hand. She could see his face and his thick black hair, his dark eyes, his fierce mustache.
Try to remember, Lisbeth, he urged.
Lisbeth tried to remember the pretty little village with thatched cottages huddled around a village green and an old pub with a weather-beaten sign of a red dragon. She tried to make the colors bright and keep the memory happy, but the dream slipped beyond her control. The village green faded. The pub sign slipped away, and she was in another hospital. This dream was vivid, its colors brilliant, the emotions fresh and frightening. Her bed was in a vast, echoing ward, lined with other beds. She could see the row of beds across from where she lay, each with its own nightstand, its blue bedspread, its inhabitants sitting or lying. The ward was noisy. The patients were all children. A nurse stood at her bedside. No, two nurses. One was in a blue dress. She had a starched apron and a small white cap and a blue belt around her waist. The other nurse had an impressive confection of white ruffles on her head, a larger apron, and a purple dress. She was gray-haired and plump.
Go ahead and tell her, nurse, said the ruffled cap.
Couldn't you do it, sister? Asked nurse.
You have to get used to this sometime, sister insisted. You might just as well start now.
I'll stay with you. Just tell her.
But, nurse protested, there are so many people asking about her. There was someone from the Foreign Office and someone from an embassy.
She's an ordinary little girl, sister said, and she has to be told.
Do it quickly, then give her a nice cup of tea and stay with her for a while. She'll be all right.
Children are very resilient.
Lisbeth, said nurse tentatively, how are you feeling, dear?
Very well, thank you, said the polite child Lisbeth.
But the adult Lisbeth, monitoring the conversation, began to feel strangely sad.
That's a good girl, said nurse.
That broken arm will be bended in no time. You'll see. And when you go to school, all your friends will want to sign your cast.
Stop shilly-shallying about, hissed sister from her position behind nurse.
Nurse patted Lisbeth's head. Such lovely ginger hair, she said.
Auburn, corrected Lisbeth. Mummy says it's called Auburn.
Mummy's quite right, said nurse.
When's Mummy coming to see me?
Asked Lisbeth.
Tell her now, Sister whispered.
Nurse made an attempt to sit on the bed beside Lisbeth, but abandoned it when Sister scowled at her. She leaned forward, her frightened young face close to the child's.
I'm afraid Mummy won't be coming, said Nurse. You must be brave, dear, very brave. It was a terrible accident, you know, and you were very lucky that you only had a broken arm. I'm afraid all the others...
Nurse's voice trailed away. Lisbeth stared at her, wide-eyed, uncomprehending.
The other people in the car, Nurse continued hesitantly. They weren't as lucky as you were, Lisbeth. The two gentlemen and your mother?
Uncle Cyril and Uncle Nicholas, Lisbeth informed her carefully.
Your two uncles. And your mother. They're...
Nurse's voice trailed away again. Sister elbowed her way forward, a thick white china teacup in her hand.
What Nurse Stebbins is trying to tell you, dear, she said, is that your two uncles and your mother were both killed in the accident. Your mother's dead, dear. Now drink this nice cup of tea.
Lisbeth Price awoke for a moment. She looked around the hospital room and reassured herself that she was, in fact, in Pittsburgh. She was no longer a child, shying away from Sister and her nice cup of tea. Well, she thought, as she drifted back to sleep, at least I know why I've always hated tea.